Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Empower Hour Show. I'm Debbie Sherry with InsideOutWellnessCoach.com, and I am a holistic codependency coach. And today, I am very excited about our show today. We're going to be, I have a guest today, and the topic is about being a parent of an addict. However, after speaking with her and reading her book, I feel like anyone that has an addict in their life is really going to identify and be able to apply some of these things to their life. And hopefully our goal today is to help those who are dealing with loved ones and addicts in their life to have some hope and to encourage you and to give you some wisdom and inspiration on how you can live your life in a way that is detached from your addict and how to do that. So today I want to introduce Sandy Swenson, who is the author of The Joey Song. Hi, Sandy.
Hi, Debbie. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm honored to be here. Thank you.
I met Sandy. I believe I found her on Facebook, didn't I, Sandy?
Yes, I do believe that's how we connected.
Uh-huh. And I inboxed her and I said, oh my gosh, I am a codependency coach, and I would love to have you on my Empower Hour show. So let's go ahead and get started. I wanted to say that I just finished the book, The Joey Song, Sunday, and I absolutely loved the book, and I loved it because it's so real and so vulnerable, and Sandy, you really share your heart and your really true feelings as if, you know, you were just talking to a girlfriend in the room or something. You're really being honest and sincere in the book, and it's a book I feel that anyone involved with an addict, especially a parent of an addict child, can so identify with. So I wanted you to, first of all, talk about what inspired you to write the Joey Song book.
I guess what inspired me, well, first of all, I had a friend who suggested I keep a journal. So that's where that started, the writing started. Was a friend suggested I keep a journal because I would spend night after night after night roaming the house, worrying about things and trying to hold on to every story that Joey had told me, every lie, everything. I was trying to hang on to it because I was afraid that if I didn't remember it, I might need it tomorrow or the next day to put together the next lie. And that was very unhealthy, but I absolutely could not let go of any of that information because I needed it. So then once I started writing it down, I was able to let go of it, which for one was very, it was very healing to just let it go. I could always refer to what I had written later when I needed to, if I needed to. Then I also just discovered that there was power in writing, and I was thinking through things much more carefully by having written them down than just having these thoughts floating around in my head. Then it came to the point where I thought, you know, I need to write the book that I wanted to read when I started on this journey, because sadly, my journey was not having any closure. And all of the books that I had read, there was closure. There was closure. Sadly, somebody died on this journey, or somebody went through recovery and had a wonderful ending. I sort of felt like a failure. And I felt like a lot of us, from what I'd seen in parent programs and things, that there's many, 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 many of us out there in the same boat as I am. And I wanted to read the book that just because my son is not in recovery, it does not mean that I didn't love my son just as much as the person whose child did end up in recovery. I wanted to write the book that was going to help parents like me.
Right. And I, too, always encourage my clients, my codependent clients, to journal. That's one of the things. If they're working with me, they have to journal. Because we keep everything so much in our head, obsessing and going over and over. I call it the codependent crazies. You just, you know, it's like chatter in the head going over and over, they said this, and they did this, and what if they're doing this, and getting it out, and we stuff our feelings a lot. So getting it out in a journal and writing out how you're feeling is really tremendous healing, mm-hmm. as you said. So you started with that journal about 2007, 2008?
Yes. Yes, I started the journal then, and then I probably started writing the book in 2009.
Okay, and then the book, you started writing the book in 2009 and finished around 2011?
I would say so, uh-huh, about 2011.
Right, and then the book just came out this past September, 2014.
That's correct.
So, to me it's a book that I think you and I, when we talked a little bit the other day, I said I feel that this is a book that needs to be in recovery centers, given to the families, because it is such a great journey of where you began as, you know, the mother of an addict and what that feels like to the place that you are now. So let's go back to the beginning when you first, the beginning of the book and the pain and the obsession. Go back to that, if you will, for us, Sandy, so some of our viewers can identify about being the parent of an addict. You know, I want to say this too, that in, you know, I've been around addiction all my life. I had a father and a husband and a sister and a brother and a lot of addiction in my family. A child which started out and we nipped in the bud with tough love right in the beginning. And so there's a difference I feel with clients who have an addictive husband or a husband who has an addictive wife than a parent who has an addictive child. So share a little bit with the viewers what that's like to have a child that is so deep into addiction. And what age was it also? Talk about the age that when Joey started with his addiction, if you would, please.
Well, it's a little fuzzy because we're not exactly sure, but I would say that his addiction probably started when he was a junior in high school, and then we didn't know what was going on, and things changed. We thought he had an eating disorder. Anyway, it's all very complicated, but I think it started when he was a junior in high school. But as parents are, we trust our children. We believe our children. We never want to believe the worst thing is happening to our children, and Joe and I didn't know what was going on right under our noses. We just didn't know. Even though we were watching, we weren't believing what we were seeing. As far as loving a child who's an addict as compared to a spouse, my spouse was not an addict, so I don't know this, but mm-hmm. I expect that, you know, with a child is yours forever. A child is yours to take care of, protect, and love forever, no matter what, no matter how old they are. You're connected. There's an umbilical connection like no other connection probably in this world. A spouse, if they were to do all the behaviors that an addicted child does, it's probably, I'm assuming, much easier just to walk away for the protection of the family and your sanity and whatnot. It's probably easier to walk away. It's very difficult to walk that invisible line of enabling and not enabling with a child who's addicted. And the love looks a lot different when you have a child who's addicted. It doesn't look like the love that a mother had thought love would look like with a child.
Yes, well, I think with a spouse or a maybe it's sibling. You know, I had two siblings. It was, the pain is there in the same behaviors, you know, the enabling and rescuing and bailing out of jail and all those things that we do, you know, as that codependent behavior, the things that we do thinking that we're saving them and we're loving them when we're really doing a lot of harm. But you can detach. You know, when my siblings were in their addiction, I made a decision to not be involved in a relationship with them. And then eventually my spouse, I ended up divorcing. But when it's a child, You know, especially as moms, you know, we're both women here, and you know, I have four children. You have another son. We're going to talk about Rick in a minute. But mothers, it's just our innate nature to take care and nurture and caretake our children. You know, when they're sick, it's built within us. It's in our radar. Mm-hmm. To take care of your children and to always be there to wipe their brow, and you know, when they're sick in the night, you know, we're the ones, we don't mind cleaning up their throw up, you know, we don't mind all those things, because that's what moms do. You know, even in the animal kingdom, the mothers are the ones that take care of the children. So when you have a child who's an addict, you of course want to take care of them and not see them hurt or not see them harmed. How did that pan out for you in the beginning? Share some of the things, Sandy, that you did in the beginning with Joey's addiction, and also some of the feelings that you had when he started really going deep into his addiction, and how that affected you and the feelings that you had about that.
Oh, my gosh. It turned my child, who is the sweetest, most loving boy, into really somebody unrecognizable. And it broke my heart. It broke my heart. And I did everything I could do, everything I could think of to help him to dig out of trouble. You know, I would go to court and I would go visit him in jail and I would, you know, loan him money even after he had lied the last time I had loaned him money. And we would loan him the car and he would use it for drug deals. And we would just always believe the next thing that he said. We wanted so badly to believe the next thing that he said, even though the last thing had been a lie. And he said horrible things to us, just horrible things to us. And we really contorted ourselves to do battle with this person that looked like our son, but was no longer our son. And we were trying to love him. Well, addiction had just turned everything crazy. And so we were all crazy. We were just all crazy. Everything we did was really, really wrong. We just did crazy things, stupid things, ridiculous things. When we talk about it, we just think, how could we have even been so crazy? Is, you know, one time Joey had said, which we don't even know that it was actually true or not, but he'd said he had pot stashed in a warehouse somewhere one time when he was in a hospital. He told us this story. And Joe and I had actually discussed how we should get rid of the pot in this warehouse. You know, what were we going to do? We're going to find the warehouse, which we didn't know where it was, in the dark of night somewhere, break in somehow, steal the pot out of this warehouse some way, and get rid of it by who knows how, and possibly get arrested ourselves. But he was on his way to rehab, and we didn't want him to get in trouble, arrested for this pot warehouse that he might have. So we were going to try to eliminate that problem since he was on his way to rehab. And we were seriously discussed that until sanity hit us as like, you know, we obviously can't do this. But we discussed it. We discussed it. We stole hospital records of Joey's, trying to get him his blood alcohol level to a judge that he was had broken probation for. And we did a lot of really crazy things.
Yes, and I loved that part of the book when you, because I really could picture it, you guys stealing the records and running out of your car, and then you said you were sitting in the car and started laughing, you know, at the craziness of it, of what you had done in order to save your son. And, you know, I think when we have children who are addicts, it's very easy to do everything that we can as a parent to protect our children from the consequences of the addiction.
Yes, yes. And
go ahead.
Oh, and well, and it just, we're constantly reacting. So we're very often not stepping back and looking at how absurd the whole picture is. We are just reacting against this beast that we don't know how to deal with. it takes a lot to step back and take a look at the big picture and see how crazy we're acting. I still look back sometimes and I'm appalled at how crazy we reacted to this, but because we couldn't love in the normal way. So we reactively loving with this thing we didn't know that we were how to deal with.
Yes. And something that you brought up too about that the whole family was like crazy. It's so important I feel it's very important that people realize that addiction is a family disease. And everyone has their role and their part in the addiction, because when you have an addict that's in the home or you have a child that you're still enmeshed with, that you're still trying to help and enable and rescue, that addict runs the show of the family.
Completely.
You know, whether you can go on vacation, whether you can do this, whether you can leave your house, everything is evolved around the addict.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The dynamics change and that they completely revolve around the addict.
And it's so important for everybody in the family to get into recovery. I had shared with you last week that sometimes when I go to treatment centers and speak to the families and I ask them how many of them are in therapy or Al-Anon or going to CODA meetings, you know, that they're getting help in therapy and support to see their role in the addict's life, and not very many of them raise their hands. I love when a treatment center has a fabulous program of recovery for the family members, because once that addict starts recovering or is, you know, in treatment or leave, whether they're in and leaving or what, whether they're in recovery or not, the family still needs help on how to handle the addict.
Oh, very much so. Joey was in three very excellent treatment centers, and the first one he went to, I went to their family program. It was a weekend family program, and I thought I was going for Joey. I thought I was going up there to support him because in 28 days he was going to be done and he was going to be fine and life was going to go back the way it was supposed to. I was shocked to discover the family program was for my husband and I, and that we had to work on our own way of dealing with his addiction, and Joey would be dealing with his own way to deal with addiction.
Yes.
I was shocked on so many levels that we needed to do this. This is that we had our part in helping him to achieve his goal and by getting our own selves healthy. And it didn't all stick. I learned things and I sort of did what I was supposed to do, but mostly I did what I wanted to do after he came out and relapsed and on for years. But with each family program and Al-Anon, I heard more, I learned more, I tried harder, I messed up a bunch, but I kept trying. But the last rehab, it really stuck. It really stuck, and maybe it was just because it was like a snowball and all the things I'd learned all the way along had collected and finally stuck. Or maybe it was because the last treatment center had not only the weekend family program, but when we got there, we had actually a counselor assigned to us who called every couple days or so to discuss how we were doing and keep us online from, you know, not enabling him and obsessing about him and becoming healthy in our own lives. And that having the family program, family support, is just unbelievably necessary.
Yes, it is. So many families believe that if the addict will get into recovery and quit drugging, then everything will be okay. And, you know, we all have had our part in that. And it's fun. I can remember the first time I went to a therapist to find out how to help my husband get off. He had relapsed, how to get off drugs. And she said to me, well, you realize that you're just as sick as he is, right? And I was so offended by that. I'm like, what do you mean? I'm not a user. I'm not. She said, well, you wouldn't be with him if you were healthy. So let's talk about some of the things that you do, you know, involved with his drug addiction. And as you were shocked, I was shocked too, that I had a part You know, and then I came to realize that all my life growing up in my alcoholic home, how I continued that, I had that part as the enabler and the rescuer and caretaker in my family, and I continued it into my adult life. So one of the things that I think that I wanted to bring up about your book that stuck out to me, that I find that parents have a really hard time with, and you were so good at writing about Joey's addiction and the manipulation that goes along with addiction.
Boy, when they say that they're master manipulators, that is so very true. And it's so painful because you think this person who loves you would never manipulate you. And yet, it's, in fact, that is how they survive, is by manipulating. And the smallest little crack, no matter who it is, somebody at work, a girlfriend, a family member, his mother, who loved and cared for him, it just didn't matter. He would do and say whatever he needed to do to get what he needed. But I think that was the beginning of me understanding, too, that this was so different from the child that I knew.
Yes.
I think this was the beginning of my understanding that there is my son and there is the addict who is wearing his face, because they are not the same person. And I think that was the beginning of my being able to distinguish that there's two here, because that's not I know my son, and my son would never do that. The manipulation was horrible.
And I think that's something really pertinent to the people that are involved with addicts and need to realize that we have to separate the addict from the person that we knew. It's not the same thing. You know how the big book says that it is an insidious, cunning disease. And it is, because when they are manipulating, when they are, you know, stealing from the family, whatever they're doing, we say, my son, you know, that's not my son, that's not my, no, but that is the disease. Right. That is the addiction. And the addiction will do anything that it can for the next high.
Yes. Yes. And so anything it can do to survive.
Yes. So being able to separate, and you talked about in the book about enabling, asking a question of, you know, that you ask yourself, am I enabling, am I doing this for my son, or is this for the addict?
Yeah, that's what I kind of keeps me in line, is I don't want to help the addict to kill my son. Mm-hmm. And so when I am going to do anything, which now I do nothing, that's out there, is that I do nothing for my son now, because he is not in recovery, and I've tried everything I can do, and all I can do now is love him and let him know that I love him, and that's all that's left for me. But I want my love and my strength and I want my son to know someday when my son does get into recovery, and someday when my son is healthy, I want my son to look back and say, my mom stood strong for me. She did what she needed to do for me. She wasn't tricked by the addict to help him. I want to be a strong foundation for my son to take his next step. And I don't want, you know, that's my job as a mom. Now, that's it. And I don't want him to see that the addict, I was helping, giving the addict a leg up. Because I know that the addict is the one who's going to kill my child. And what kind of a mom am I if I'm going to be giving that addict a leg up? So that really keeps me in line.
That's great. And that's such a healthy perspective, Sandy, to have. We were talking about, you know, when people or parents or people in recovery, not with addict, or not the addict, but us that have these codependent behaviors, that when we say, oh, but it's so hard, and share with us, just you share with us. I don't want to share. You share with what you said to me about it being so hard.
Well, it is hard. It's the hardest thing you've probably ever had to do. And I would say when people say, you know, tough love, you know, meaning that it's tough on the kid, you're being mean to the kid. No, it's tough because it's tough to do. It's just tough. It is goes against every maternal instinct. It's hard. It's really hard. But when we sit there and say, oh, this is so hard, I can't do this, it makes me sad, whatever we say, because I've said it all, is then think, you know, we're expecting our children, or we're expecting, I'm expecting my son to do the hard work of recovery. I want him to get better, and he's got a long road ahead of him, and it's going to be hard. It's going to be hard to quit, and it's going to be hard to do all the steps that he needs to do. I don't want him to sit back and say, oh, this is hard. I can't do it. This is hard. I want him to do it, no matter how hard it is. And so if I expect that from my son, then I need to have the same expectations from myself. I need to expect that I will also do the hard work that I need to do to support his recovery, and it is hard, but I will be the example of doing the hard thing, no matter how tough it is, and stick with it, no matter what, because I want to be the example. I want to be the example of doing the hard thing, no matter how tough. For my son.
That's right. Learning to detach and not enable and say no is hard. Saying, I'm not going to bail you out of jail anymore. I'm not going to. Now, with Joey, Joey's about 27 now?
27.
Yeah, and Joey's down here in South Florida somewhere, and after he left another treatment center, correct?
Correct.
And you live in Austin, Texas, so you share with me that you see Joey like once a year in April. You come down and you all go to lunch?
Yes.
However, you don't try to get Joey. You're not there to get him in a treatment center anymore, bail him out of jail, talk to judges, anything like that anymore?
No, I've done all that. I've done it all. I've done it all, and speaking of the manipulation, Joey more often than not used all those things for his own purposes or to hurt us or something. It did not work. It went actually helped the addict, everything we did. He was not as clean cut as it seems when I say we tried to, you know, interfere with the judges or whatever. It always turned sour. It always spun around backwards and ended up helping the addict somehow. So no, don't do that anymore. He knows now. I've been going down to South Florida for years, at least since 2008, every April to see him. And I text him or email him and let him know that I'm coming, and he may or not reply. 1 year I didn't get to see him because he was running from trouble. But I go down there and I find him, and we have lunch, and we don't talk about addiction at all ever anymore. There's no sense in me saying, how are you doing? Or there's no sense. I don't need to know that. I can't do anything about it. It's not mine to own, so we talk about other things. We laugh. We hug. He knows I love him. I know he loves me. I don't know what he's going to do when he leaves me, but we are making a memory for that moment, and someday when he's ready to get in recovery, which I hope he will someday, hope that by him knowing that I'm out there and his family's out there, that we're all out here, we love him, he knows that, and it's a reason that someday might speak louder to him in one ear than the addict is talking to him in the other ear. I just feel like he knows we love him, and there is no more of us trying to manipulate him either.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And the freedom that comes from that, of letting go. And I could relate to, in the book, when you were talking about, of course, back then when I was so hooked into my addict at that time, which was my husband, was more that we didn't have Facebook then. Actually, we had, I think he had a beeper. You know, he had a cell phone, he had a beeper. So it wasn't like we didn't have texting then either. But I can remember, like, trying to find out every single thing the addict was doing, where they were going, what they were saying, and share how the craziness of what you were doing with the email and the Facebook.
Well, I had, from the very beginning, I followed everything because I had his email and I had his Facebook, so I could see what he was doing. And the further he got away from us, the more obsessed I got with checking things on email to track him, because if he would tell us A, B, or C, I would get online and see that really none of that was true. Actually, you know, it was something totally different. So it helped me, I felt, to put all the pieces together so I would know what was happening, so I would have some control in this situation, so that when I needed it, I'd have the truth and not just the things he wanted me to know. That evolved. I was checking it many, many times a day. My husband wanted no part of it. Well, sort of. He wanted no part of it in that he thought it was unhealthy, very unhealthy, and that my Al-Anon group would not approve at all. And I said I didn't care. I was doing it anyway because I needed to know this stuff. And he would stand there in the door. He wouldn't come in the room and be a part of it, but he'd stand at the door and let me tell him what was being said. So he wanted it too, but he was, you know, we were just sick. We were just so sick and twisted there with the whole Facebook thing. And then finally, when Joey was at his last rehab center, there was something on his Facebook or email that was, I knew he was planning to leave rehab or something. I don't remember what it was. But I knew that I had to tell the counselors at the rehab center. I knew that in telling the counselors at the rehab center that I was going to be, you know, for one, showing that I was a busybody mother who had been snooping all along instead of being healthy. And two, I was going to be, my son was going to know that I'd been looking at all this and was going to shut down the window. And I really didn't know if I could do it or not, but then I knew I had to because they needed to know what he knew. And of course, he shut me down and that was the end of that. Except that we were then friends. I no longer had his password, but we were still friends on Facebook. And so then I was obsessively just checking in to see what he was writing, because he would post things about parties or whatever, and he would put them up and take them down really quickly. So I was on there all day long tracking him. And finally, I said, this is not healthy at all. I've got to stop this. I've just got to stop doing this. This is killing me. So I went out with a bang, and I posted his last mugshot on his Facebook page with a picture of him when he was looking more healthy. And I said to his friends on Facebook, it was an announcement for his friends. I was saying, this is what addiction has done to my son. Stop enabling him if you love him, or something to that effect. So I was trying to get him to defriend me, because a mother can't defriend her own son. That's just...
Right. Exactly. And he did. He did defriend you, didn't he?
Not that time. Maybe that was the time. I did two things in a row, and I forget what the first one was. The first one, maybe I just said, people don't enable him. Maybe it was the second. And then he said, Mom, quit posting on my page. Then I posted the mugshots, and then he befriended me.
Yes. So
that was the end of that. Then I could no longer snoop. But it was really, I was obsessed. I needed to know what was going on, and that was fairly late in the game, that whole thing. I was writing my book when I was, you know.
So, well, I think it was your last connection.
It was the last connection.
Had to find out, you know, that little... Just having that string of connection to your son to still know what was going on in his life, even though some of it was painful. But that is the obsession and our addiction. Our addiction is with the addict.
Yes.
And trying to fix and heal and get the addict to get better.
Yes. Whatever we can do and anything we know can somehow help them in some way, which is really silly because nothing I ever knew helped him in any way. Really, nothing that I ever knew helped him in any way. And a year or so later, after he defriended me, he sent me a friend request. And part of me wanted to accept it. Because, of course, it's my son. I would love to. But then I knew that I was healthy because it took me 2 weeks to think about it. And then finally I sent him an email or a text or something. And I said, you know, I love you more than anything, but it's not healthy for me to be your friend on Facebook. So, no. And he said he understood and thought that was huge progress. But I had to kind of fight with myself for 2 weeks.
That was. I remember reading that in the book. That was huge progress for you to say no, because he was giving you an invitation to see what was going on in his life again.
Yes.
Yeah. So very healthy, Sandy. Very healthy. You're such a great inspiration to parents on the journey of having an addict child, and to where you are today from the beginning of the book. That's what I loved is because I read the book in about 10 days and seeing the book, where you were in the beginning and what you and Joe were doing in the beginning with your son, I could so identify with the enabling and rescuing and doing everything and flying here and doing this and spending money, and to where you are today is very inspirational that you've gotten healthy and you've gotten it. Now, I know that some of the parents probably viewing today too. I want to talk a minute. I think it's important for us to talk about when we have an addict child and we have other siblings in the home. I know in growing up, my brother started using drugs. I'm the oldest of four, and he was the third child, and he started smoking pot heavily about age 12. And then his addict by 14, 15, he was full-blown into addiction. But I can remember how he was the center of attraction in our family. And, what he was doing, because he was acting out, he was really being the scapegoat in the family and doing things, jail, arrested, and going to the police station in the middle of the night and those type of things. So much attention was given to my brother. And, of course, my parents weren't in recovery at that time either. They just were doing like you and Joe in the beginning, just not knowing how to handle this thing. So talk about about Rick, your younger son, Joey's little brother, and how he handled this and what happens to the other siblings when we're really into our addiction of obsessing about the addict.
Well, in our family, Ricky was he was just abandoned over and over and over and over again while we went off to rescue Joey. And it started, we lived in India, and that was when we thought Joey had an eating disorder, and I took him back to the United States for 4 months. But at first, Joe and I had both left Ricky there with a friend. Good friend, but still, it was a foreign country. We left our son, who was only 13 or 12 at the time, in a foreign country. And that was the beginning. And I stayed in the United States for 4 months. And when we moved back to the United States, on Ricky's, I think it was his very first day of high school in a new school back in the United States, Joey had tried to commit suicide the night before, and I flew out before breakfast. So it was just like that over and over and over and over. When Ricky graduated from high school, Joey was in jail. It was always, we were always in all the rehabs in between, and the time he was in the car accident, that was over in Easter, and we were down in Florida for a couple weeks while Joey was clinging to life, and we just left Ricky a lot, and those were the big dramatic events. Then there were the less dramatic events of just the all day long getting the calls from collection agencies or hearing the ambulances or getting the bills for overdose, ambulance, life support, and all that. It was just, we were consumed. And Ricky, bless his heart, he just kept taking one step after another. He didn't cause any drama. He was solid. I don't know how. He didn't complain. I would tell him that we love him just as much as we love Joey, but we have to take care of this because this is what we've got. And I would get to him again when I had time. But, we were still dealing with this when Ricky went off to college. So Rick never had a real uninterrupted time of just a normal life. I think that he suffered a lot from watching what was going on. I think he suffered, you know, from being abandoned. I think he suffered from watching the pain caused his parents, watching the crazy things, really scary, horrible things that were happening in his life that he and we, obviously, had no control over. But he's an amazing young man. People ask me all the time, you know, does he resent this? And he may somewhere deep down, but he's never told me. He's never expressed resentment of any of this. He's just taken it as it is what it is, and I'm going to do my part and just keep plugging along. And he is just an amazing young man. He doesn't seem to hold resentments about this at all. He loves his brother, but he also has no relationship with his brother. You know, when Joey was, or when Rick was 12 or 13, Joey was 16 or whatever the ages were. They haven't known each other since then, because after that, Joe was an addict. And so now they're 25 and 27. So very, very sadly, you know, that my younger son didn't ever have, he had an older brother until their teens, and then he basically had no brother, which is very, very, very sad.
Yes, yes. It does. You know, I wanted to bring that up about how it affects every person in the family. And I know, you know, since you have been in recovery and you're so much healthier, one of the things that we can do, you know, is sitting down and communicating with those other children and siblings about what's going on and how you're feeling and how you're noticing, you know, that they could be feeling abandoned, that they could be feeling alone, and that the other sibling gets all the attention. And then I've had parents who, after they've gotten healthy, have made amends, you know, to their children and said, I didn't know any better, and this is what I was going to do, but I realized that you were being neglected at the time.
Yes.
I just want to make amends to you and let you know, that I didn't know any better, and I'm sorry. And so we need to have that awareness about
yes,
when we have an addict child, of what's happening with the other siblings. And even if we have an addict spouse, you know, I was so obsessed with my addict spouse that I look back in some of the ways that I wasn't there for my children, my four children, because I was so focused on the addict and what was going on in the addict. You know, if there was a crisis with the addict, no matter what was going on, everything else stopped.
Yes, everything stopped. And there were times I felt so guilty, so guilty. I thought, you know, I'm trying to save one and maybe throwing the other one under the bus. But I didn't know what to do. I didn't feel like I had a choice. I felt like this, you know, I had to save the one. That's clear. I have to do that. The other one's a maybe. So I had to do the one that was right in front of my face.
Well, the one that was drowning, you know.
Yeah.
Your child drowning, you're going to jump in the water to save the child. Or if you see, you know, the train coming, you know, to hit your child, run over your child, the mother's going to run out there on the tracks and try to pull her child off the tracks.
Exactly. But we did that for years. We kept doing that, and Rick was just left there, and I feel terrible. There were just times I knew that I was making... There was no good choice in this choice, but I had no option. I do know now, though, of course, that we weren't handling it the right way.
And our heart, when we do that, when we are enabling and rescuing and doing those things, we really don't know. That's the denial that we have, that we really don't know that we're harming the addict. We really feel that we're coming from a place of love and caring about this person.
Yes.
I always say, you know, codependents are some of the most loving people on the earth.
Mm-hmm.
Except we don't have boundaries a lot of times with that, and can be like that to our own detriment. I wanted to bring up and talk about a couple of quotes from the book.
Okay.
One was, and I want to talk about this because I can remember this is something that's so prevalent, and it's about, I want to talk about walking on eggshells with the addict. you know, when Joey was living at home, and when you are with an addict, or you have a child, an addict child at home, or a spouse, and you said that I see no evil, hear no evil, and speak no evil because I don't want to chase you away.
Oh, yes. Boy, do I remember those days. He was there. He'd been in trouble. You know, he'd been out of the home. And then he'd come back to live with us. And at least if he was home with me, I felt like I had some control. He was safe. He had a roof over his head. If I confronted him with these things that I was seeing and hearing and whatnot that I knew were wrong, then I would chase him away and I would lose him, and then it would be my fault. And it was a very hard, hard time.
And that's something that we all do until we get healthier, yeah, is people please the addict, that we walk on eggshells, yes, because we don't want to upset them. So there again, that's when we're not being true to ourselves. It's like that big white elephant in the room that nobody wants to talk about.
Definitely. Go ahead.
Well, it's just we don't want to confront anything, and we know we can't change what we don't confront. We don't want to confront anything. We don't want to share how we're really feeling. We don't want to say anything that's going to get them upset because then they might go out and use. And so really it's, you know, we think we have all this control over the act.
Well, you know, at the time when Joey had come to live in the house, the time you're talking about when I was walking on those eggshells, we had just come back from California, where Joey had tried to commit suicide, and we left college and we brought him back home. And the doctor, the very first doctor we'd ever seen about any of this, you know, because he'd taken drugs and alcohol, that's how he tried to kill himself. And the doctor that we had talked to, he had said that do not walk on eggshells. We didn't know yet that this was an addiction problem still. We didn't know that. Well, now we're dealing with not the eating disorder, but now depression, we're thinking of it. So, but actually, he was an addict at this point. But anyway, the doctor at that point had said, do not walk on eggshells. Because I had asked him, so how do we treat Joey? You know, if he's sad, do we just give him everything he wants? And he said, do not walk on eggshells with your son. Treat him just as you would have treated him before, the same way you would treat your other son, because you cannot control his behavior no matter how you act. He told us that.
Yes.
And, you know, that's the basic bit of information that we've built our health on, but we didn't pay attention to that at the beginning. Had we, things would have probably turned out better much faster. But we just couldn't do it. It was very hard to do. We could have done it. We just didn't believe it, maybe. You know?
Yeah, it's very hard not to do that in the beginning until you get healthier. Mm-hmm. Another quote that I love that you said, I'm prepared to allow my child to die because getting close to death may be the only thing that saves him.
Hmm.
I love that because I can remember being in an Al-Anon meeting with my ex's father, who was the great enabler, and the facilitator said to him, you are going to love your son. He said, I can't help it, I love him so much. And he said, well, you're going to love him to death. And so when you said that, you know, that you were prepared to allow my child to die because getting close to death may be the only thing that saves him.
Yeah. Boy, let me tell you, hearing that I wrote that is really, it just, those are words no mother ever, ever, ever should have to say. Addiction is a horrible disease, you know. But it's true is that I came to realize that my addict, you know, he's not going to hit bottom laying around on a bed of roses. He's going to hit bottom skating on thin ice. And if we keep giving him that little bed of roses, he will... most likely, we never know what's going to happen. There's no predicting, but chances are that he is going to use himself to death. But if the circumstances are not quite so cushy, if they have to face consequences, if they don't have a comfy bed to sleep in, if they don't have somebody taking care of their every need, life gets a little more uncomfortable. And I believe that that is when they might really want the help.
Yes, when they don't have all these enablers and people rescuing them, then making it cushionier, making it soft like a bed of roses. You said of all the people who have suffered from addiction, the ones who have risen like a phoenix faced tough love early on. I soft love Joey too often, fooling myself I was helping. I really liked that quote also, because I have found that too, that the quicker that we can do the tough love and learn those things in the beginning, and why I encourage, if you have a child that's just starting in drugs, or, you know, get yourself, focus on yourself, get yourself into recovery where you have a good therapist, a good interventionist, you know, somebody that's giving you advice how to handle an addict, because someone that's a pro about handling addiction and can tell you what you're doing wrong and what you need to be doing, because the quicker we can have, you know, pull away and let them have their consequences from their actions, so a lot of times the quicker they can get into recovery.
I think that's true. And the reality is that look at all of us who've helped our children, helped, enabled, and it didn't save them from not having an overdose or whatever. So the helping and then the helping and the enabling, that's not a guarantee that we're going to keep our child out of trouble at all. So it's, you know, we have to let them find their own desire to get well, and we can't cushion them from that. And I also just want to say, too, that by us taking the effort to get healthy ourselves, some of us feel like that's a selfish thing to do, and it's not a selfish thing to do. It's a very healthy thing to do, not only for ourselves, but once we're healthy, then the rest of the family is also healthy. And addiction does not need to spread through the entire family. It can stop with us and our behavior. And when our loved one is ready to embrace recovery, then that addict will come back to a healthy family and a healthy mom and a healthy relationship, that one that has not been destroyed by years of lies and manipulations. The addict will come back to a family that's pretty nicely intact and waiting for him with open arms.
I think. Exactly. And for the addict to, once they've been in recovery, to come home to a family who knows how to set healthy boundaries and knows how to detach and knows how to not enable the addict is such an act of love to the addict.
Yes.
And if he's working a real true program, then they will, you know, they will appreciate that.
Yes.
If they're really working your program. So let's talk about, for a minute, the good that's come out. Tell us about Bistro Boys and how that came about.
Well, Bistro Boys is a program I started when I lived in Bethesda, Maryland. And there was a place called the National Center for Children and Families. And they had 20 young men that they, it was a group home for 20 young men. And, you know, there comes a point with Joey, it's all happened around the same time, when I realized that I could no longer do things for him. I could love him, but I couldn't do anything for him anymore. But I still had the need to do that, and there was this home, and I started this program called the Bistro Boys, where the Junior Women's Club of Chevy Chase and I, some of the members, we would go in there and we would cook with these young men and grocery shop with them twice a week, and cook a meal, sit down and have a meal together, grocery shop together. It was lovely. It was just lovely. It was an amazing program. It was non-threatening. It was very sit down and just enjoy time together and goofing around in the kitchen. It was safe, you know, as far as, you know, they didn't have to worry about being judged. It was just like it would happen in your own kitchen at home. And I felt like, you know, these boys, I didn't know their histories. That wasn't why we were there. We just knew that something happened in their life, and they weren't able to be with their parents. their mom, for whatever reason, wasn't able to help them right now, but I could do something. And my belief is that, you know, we all have the hands of God, and if we all do a little bit of something for somebody else, and I could just do a little something for these guys, make a little difference in their night a couple nights a week, and somebody somewhere will be able to do the same thing for Joey. And I just believe that is, I just believe that. We can't do everything for our own children for sometimes, for so, who knows what reasons, but somebody else can. And so that was the, what was behind the Beast of Life.
I think that's beautiful. And, you know, paying it forward like that, there's a scripture in Proverbs that says when we water others, we ourselves become watered.
Yes.
And I so believe that when we are reaching out and helping others, it helps heal our soul.
Yes.
Especially, you know, you helping those boys. It's planting the seed. It's sowing the seed for some other person, maybe a woman or maybe a man or some other person down here in South Florida that's going to be that helping hand to your son, Joey.
Yes. Yes.
So in closing here, Sandy, I want to ask if you could say anything today in closing, a word of advice or anything that you could say to mothers or fathers of an addict child, what would you say?
I would say that letting go is not the same thing as giving up, right, and that our love for them does not change if we let go. We're only letting go of the things that we can do nothing about. And I guess that's the most important thing, is just to understand that distinction.
And letting go is about letting go of the enabling, the rescue, the fixing, all the things that we take responsibility for in trying to help the child.
Those things, exactly. And also that in, if we try to fix everything for them, we are essentially saying we don't think they can do this. And in fact, it's their own disease, and they must know how to do this. We need to reflect our belief that, yes, you can do this. And that's what I think letting go. It's hard. I don't know that letting go is the best word, but it's the word, it's the phrase we've got, and I believe that it encompasses all of those things.
Yes, and letting go does, as you said, letting go doesn't mean I don't love you and then I'm not here for you. It means that I can't do it for you.
Yes.
I cannot do it for you. And it is help, you know, teaching them that every choice we make in life has a consequence for each one of us.
Mm-hmm.
And allowing them to have the consequences of their choice. So, Sandy, tell our viewers today how they can get in touch with you and where they can buy your book.
Okay, I have a blog, sandyswenson.com, and I write short little blogs on there, hopefully inspiring for parents of addicts. And I have the book, The Joey Song, A Mother's Story of Her Son's Addiction, and that can be purchased in bookstores or on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, it's in libraries, so...
Awesome. I have just loved having the hour went way too fast because we could talk about this topic for a couple of hours or more and just talk about what it's like to have a child, you know, or an addict in our life. And so thank you so much, Sandy. I so appreciate you being my guest today on the Empower Hour show. And thank you all who are viewing the show today. And I am Debbie Sherry, Holistic Codependency Coach, and you can reach me contact me through my website, insideoutwellnesscoach.com, or email me at debbie@insideoutwellnesscoach.com if you're interested in codependency coaching. So thank you again, Sandy, and I look forward to our continued friendship and staying in touch.
Thank you so much, Debbie. I'm happy to have been here. Thank you.
And God bless. I know you've helped a lot of parents today, hon. Thank you so much. And happy holidays to everyone. And I will see you again in 2015. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you.